Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's May the 30th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we'll begin with something I hope will become a regular feature on this show, and that's giving a shout-out to new arrivals in the Northwest Homeland. One in Livingston, Montana, and one young man here in Seattle whom I hope to be getting together with soon. Welcome home, comrades. Now, while I'm sitting here jaw-jacking on my computer, you guys are the ones who are going to win this thing for us. Right, we've got an email here from James in the UK as follows. Dear Harold, please talk about the decapitation of a white soldier by black Islamists in Woolwich. Don't be too Muslim-friendly. It pisses me off when you do that. Signed, James. Right, let's talk about the beheading of the British soldier in Woolwich. I presume that by now pretty much everyone with a computer has seen and heard of the incident last week that James is referring to, and seen the videos which were shot on the sidewalk after this incident by people with camcorder apps on their phones. The thing that impressed me is that while this nigger is ranting and raving and waving a bloody meat cleaver in the air with a decapitated body lying in the street about 20 feet away, some white woman is standing there talking to him, supposedly trying to talk him out of chopping up any more people. Now, she's either very brave or very liberal and very stupid and honestly had some notion that you can reason with an animal who has just murdered a white man for the color of his skin. Well, she was lucky. This time the creature decided not to bury his meat cleaver in her skull. I guess the old saying is true. The good Lord looks out for drunkards, fools, and children. James, I don't know if you're familiar with a legal term called res ipsa loquitur. It's Latin, and it means the thing speaks for itself. I don't feel I have to comment overmuch on something like this when Beavis and Butthead can go to YouTube, which is where most white young people seem to live on the internet these days, and see it for themselves. Interestingly, last week I had a conversation with another comrade about this incident, urging me to write a big long article about it for Northwest Observer and the Thought Crime blog, stating the obvious. This is a bad thing, on the grounds that it will finally, quote-unquote, wake white people up. Folks, I'll say this again. The problem is not getting white people to, quote-unquote, wake up. To be blunt, I think they're a lot more awake than we give them credit for, and probably about as awake as they're ever going to be. The problem lies in getting white people to act, to do what we all know perfectly well we need to be doing in order to actually change the world and bring this system down, and that the overwhelming majority in America or the UK never will do. They have had that strength of character and that idealistic willingness to sacrifice themselves for the good of others bred out of them, socially engineered out of them, psychologically conditioned out of them, some combination of all of the above. But the simple fact is that the overwhelming majority of white people are going to remain completely passive, right up to the point of their death. We need to accept this as a fact of life and deal with it. I've told you before, when the shit finally does hit the fan, it's going to be our 5% of the population against their 5% of the population, most of whom the respective dictatorships will hire to fight for money, like the British hired the Hessians during the American Revolution. The remaining 90% of the white population will simply sit there and watch it all on YouTube. As to my being quote-unquote Muslim-friendly, I'm not. Now, I have explained this several times before. It's not so much the anti-Muslim part of Europe's so-called movement modernization that I'm against. It's the pro-Jew and pro-faggot bit that has destroyed the English Defense League and the British National Party and other such groups as effective political vehicles for a white Western resurgence. Remember the immortal saying of A.K. Chesterton, "If they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true." I find it odd that these so-called nationalists can't find any solution to the Muslim problem that doesn't involve letting in Jews and shirtlifters and more or less letting them take over. Whose interests does that serve? Western civilization? Let me ask you something. What the hell is the point in driving out the Muslims if we're going to be ruled by Jews and bugger boys afterwards? But I do understand that to our European comrades, the perspective is different. And that's one reason we got Lord Lucan appearing on here fairly regularly now, so he can rant and rave about Muslims. Or in this week's podcast, about Tories.
Toryism and the American Revolution. Toryism means one law for the rich, or the aristocrat, and another law for the poor, or the commoner. After the American Revolution, 65,000 Tories left America for England or Canada. The French Revolution was much harder on the Tories or aristocrats than the American Revolution. They sent the upper class to Madame Guillotine. There are other forms of Toryism, such as Judaism. In the synagogue, they teach from the Talmud, one law for the Jew and another law for the Gentile. Islam teaches one law for the Muslim and another for the unbeliever. Yet another form of Toryism is one law for the police and another for the citizen. Now, in the last case, a citizen in Chicago faces 75 years behind bars for filming the police. The Tories or redcoats that run this country have made it a felony to film the police, but the police can film the citizens. The passage of such laws represent treason against the revolution. The revolution was fought against the Tories. The statement that we hold these truths self-evident, that all men were created equal, has nothing to do with biology. It is a statement opposing the ruling class of England and the political party that represented the ruling class, a statement against the Tories. America is meant to be a republic, whereby all citizens can have equality before the law. Therefore, defense lawyers have to have the same powers that the prosecution has. That is not the case anymore. In the case of Steele, the judge and the prosecution were behaving exactly the same as the Tories. The FBI and all other federal law enforcement have become the redcoats. Now, back in the old days, our founding fathers understood the necessity of killing the redcoats. These days, however, far too many people are listening to the ideas of Gandhi, the non-violent overthrow of our dictatorship. The ideas of Gandhi cannot be applied to our current situation. Gandhi wanted independence of India, which is not the same as a revolution. If you give a nation independence, the occupying troops have to leave, whereas in a revolution, the ruling class stand to lose everything, including their lives. In the French Revolution, the ruling class lost everything, including their heads. Our next revolutionist country is going to be a French Revolution. All the Tories will find themselves being executed for being traitors to the American Revolution. If you are a policeman and you're obeying the orders of a Jew, then you have become a traitor to America, and for that for which it stands for, with freedom and justice for all. The darling philosopher for the conservatives is Ayn Rand. She, of course, was a Jew. Now, Disraeli started the new conservative party. The Tories in England like to call themselves conservative. Disraeli was obviously a Jew. Disraeli without the D is Israeli, is it not? This idea that Jews are socialists is absolute horse manure. Now, anyone stupid enough to believe that Jews are socialists will end up getting then-assed Jewed. Jews are Tories, and the purpose of running a socialist party is to run it for themselves. Now, let's take a look at the British Labour Party of Tony Blair. He should be called Tory Blair. He made friends with the Jews, and every working-class Brit got their stupid-ass Jewed. A real socialist party was the German Socialist Party of Julius Streicher. He joined his party with the German Labour Party from Munich. All cabinet members of the National Socialist German Labour Party, except one, were former Marxists. Mussolini was a Marxist editor before he became the leader of his own party. Even Sir Oswald Mosley was a former member of a Labour Party. If you look at any socialist or Labour Party that allows Jews to become members, the working class will end up getting Jewed. The Protestant martyr, Luther, wrote The Jews and Their Lies, and Karl Marx wrote the essay The Jewish Question. The darling of the Tories is Ayn Rand, and she supports unlimited immigration, and unlimited immigration is the policy of the Tories. Over here in America and everywhere else, the philosophy of Ayn Rand is followed. The word Tory means to be understood by every American, because a Tory is a traitor to the American Revolution, and the Redcoats were the army enforcing the law of the Tories. Now, in our country, we have a journalist who wants to have an armed demonstration on Washington, D.C. Now, does anyone in this country understand what that will lead to? He says that he could muster thousands of supporters. Oh, yeah? Let me tell you what I think. Every single person on that march had better be prepared for Concord, because the only way that the ruling class in America is going to obey a government for and by the people in this country is by means of a bloodbath. The police will obey the order to shoot citizens, just the same as the Redcoats. And many years ago, after the First World War, the vets demonstrated for their war benefits. The soldiers in uniform obeyed the order to shoot the vets. Now, in northern Idaho, there was a strike by the White Mine Workers Union. The former slaves, the black soldiers, obeyed the order to shoot the striking workers. History states clearly that, if ordered to do so, the police will shoot citizens that demand a government that represents the people. A government for and by the people in this country only exists on paper. Have enough Americans woken up to the real state of American politics? Now, according to my mother, America is 100 years, politically speaking, behind Europe. If she is correct, then the year is 1913, and the First World War hasn't started yet. And that war was started by the assassination of the Archduke of Austria. The Labour Party had not yet come to power. National Socialism did not exist. Now, Harold Covington might not agree with such an analysis of America. The crash of the dollar has not yet started, and the Weimar Republic has not yet come to America. Back in the 1930s, Americans still believed the press and the radio, but times are changing. Eventually, Americans will begin to realize that the National Socialist Party was a Labour Party, and a Labour Party is a workers' party, and the Jews are the Tories. In the Northwest Republic, no Tory can be permitted to reside or work. Jews, Muslims, and any other form of double-standard morality cannot be allowed to live here either. And finally, it doesn't matter how many Christians are working for a law enforcement agency. The only thing that matters is the head of that agency. If the head of that agency is a Jew or another form of Toryism, then the head of that department is a traitor to the American Revolution. If you obey his orders, such as, say, killing Christians at Waco, Texas, then you have become a traitor to America. Jesus said, "Those that live by the sword shall perish by the sword." But whose sword are they going to perish by? In the French Revolution, it was by the sword of the working class. And who are the working class in America? The rednecks.
Okay, now, James from the UK, I have a proposal for you and for all our European listeners to Radio Free Northwest, and I'm entirely serious. If you think I'm quote-unquote Muslim-friendly, even though nothing could be further from the truth, why don't you talk to us about Muslims and about all the other things that are happening in Great Britain these days that you're not allowed to talk about in your own country without fear of arrest? The same goes for all you Europeans and Aussies and Canucks. Now, if you are willing to take the risk, and it is a risk, Then make me an MP3 audio file and send it to me using whatever anonymous name you choose to use. Hereward the Wake or the Earl of Frumpington Smythe or whatever you want to call yourself. Now, for an added layer of security, you don't have to send it directly to me. You can use sendspace.com or usendit.com, and there are ways that you can upload the file without using your own computer to do so. In fact, I recommend that you don't. Leave as little cyber trail as possible between your audio file and your hard drive because your native secret police there will be looking for you. This is an invitation that I would like to extend to all of our foreign comrades, especially in Great Britain, Canada, Australia, and Sweden, where for some reason we seem to have a growing listenership to Radio Free Northwest, and also, of course, to any Germans who want to chip in and talk about National Socialism and the other things that they're forbidden to talk about in their own land. If you can get me an MP3 audio file in which you say out loud the things that your laws at home forbid you to say without risking prison, then I will broadcast it to our wee little listenership of 5,500 or so people per week. And I will see what I can do about getting some of our American comrades over here to make YouTube videos of your speeches and upload them from here in the United States, where there is at least some theoretical freedom of speech remaining. Now let me repeat this. You need to understand that there is a fair amount of personal risk involved in doing this. You need to take all reasonable security precautions. Remember what happened to Simon Shepherd and Stephen Whittle, the heretical two, who were arrested and got 7-year sentences for displaying a 30-year-old Robert Crumb cartoon on their website, which was hosted here in America, where it's not illegal. They were arrested and convicted. They tried to flee to the United States and claim political asylum, and after a year or so in jail in Los Angeles, they were deported back to Britain by a Jewish judge here and got 7-year sentences, all for the horrible crime of posting a 30-year-old Robert Crumb cartoon on their website, which, I know, if you're not American, you wouldn't get that, but it's not only not illegal under our laws, but Crumb is actually considered something of an icon among the left-wing hippy-dippy 60s retreads over here. You ever heard of the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers? He was involved in that with another cartoonist named Gilbert Shelton, but we won't get into that. But put it this way, the idea of sending anybody to jail over a Robert Crumb cartoon is just ludicrous. But that's what the British government did. I know for a fact that the FBI listens to this podcast and archives it, so we have to assume that Scotland Yard and the secret police in your own countries are listening as well. I'm sure that they are entirely capable of doing voice prints on any segment of this podcast they don't like and trying to apprehend you and match your voice to whatever illegal racial commentary is made, so forth and so on. So yet again, I have to caution you that this could be dangerous. The upside is that for once, just once, for a few minutes, you will be able to say out loud what your government doesn't want you saying and doesn't want you thinking. I think there may be some of you who are willing to take that risk, just to taste that freedom for a few brief minutes. Now, let me hear from you if you're interested, but I suggest that you use a false name and a web-based email account, which you only access from a computer, not your own. Now, you also need to remember that the FBI now admits that they intercept and retain and archive every single email that is sent in this country. Yeah, I know, it seems like logically it should be impossible for us to operate at all. Now, I think that's why they admit that they're doing this, intercepting and archiving all emails and most cell phone texts. They want us to know that they're doing it so that we're so depressed and frightened of their surveillance that we don't even make the attempt to resist. Now, the only way that this will ever end is the white people of the earth are going to have to tell these dictatorships to go fuck themselves. We will think what we want, write what we want, and say what we want. I wish I could promise that this would lead to some kind of big mass mob in Trafalgar Square for a British spring, but it probably won't. All I can give you is the motto that I myself try to live by. Speak what is true, do what is right, and fear no one. So, you foreign comrades, think about it and let me hear from you. This is from Comrade Lawrence in Kentucky. Dear HAC, I had some time off today and I was just sitting around banging on my flat top instead of the laptop and came up with this. It ain't much and I damn sure am not the one to perform it, but I thought you might get a kick out of it. I do realize I can't sing or play, but I think the lyrics are getting a message together. Maybe you guys know someone who can do something good with it. Maybe not. If all he does is get a good laugh out of it, it's worth sending. Laugh out loud. Do what you want with it. Still more to go into it as far as lyrics. Well, guys, we're getting some comic book artists doing NF stuff for us, and we've got Comrade Arland in Britain who does racial songwriting and singing on the piano. So here's Lawrence from Kentucky on a guitar. This is a work in progress, so that if you want to send me comments on this, I'll forward them to our young Bob Dylan out there in the bluegrass country.
Many times our people have been through some hard times. We're about to take the biggest fall. Through all the rain and the gray skies, we got the spirit to make it. Now can't you see, there's a place for you and me. We can take that stand against that fall, against that fall. Take a look around you, tell me, can't you see, our people without a home. We were told what to do now, just 14 words. Will you heed, or will you heed the call? Now can't you see, there's a place for you and me, where we take that stand against that fall, stand against that fall.
Just a short burst, working on it. Needs a lot of work, I know, but hell, just wanted to get your opinion, that kind of thing. Keep up the fight. You know you're right.
Good evening, comrades. Recently I was asked, what are your favorite books in terms of the books that you've reviewed? And one that I could absolutely reread and continue to get lost in is Hold Back This Day. Because this is so well done as far as describing current and future issues. And it's really such an exciting and interesting book that really I can't recommend it enough. I think it's, I would say, endlessly fascinating. I could start rereading it right now in the middle of this talk, really. And then another one that I really enjoyed, and it's really very much like Hold Back This Day, is Mister. That was something that I just couldn't put down, and that's about an Englishman that goes on a business trip in Spain, and there's a lot of current sort of political references. It seems to be set, I think, slightly in the future. So that's another one, very similar two books that are very similar. I also happen to love The Future of Man by Robert Clark Graham because it's a book that deals somewhat with the issue of eugenics, which I think is a very important matter. Another book is A Life in the Political Wilderness. And what I love about this book is it deals with strategy. I think that's, obviously, that's very important because I think clearly we have strategizing deficits or have had quite a bit. As far as a European futuristic book, of course, I enjoyed Anachrofuturism. Even though it's in a lot of ways, I suppose it's a contradictory view from Harrell's in some respects. But, you know, I always appreciate European writers. The certain level of sophistication that I have to admit is something that I value. Of course, anything by Savitri Devi is important to read. I would say that I agree with many of her views, although at times she has kind of a vengeful bent, which I disagree with. I don't see that at all. I believe much more in dispassionate adherence to duty rather than any kind of vengeful feelings. And then, of course, I have a translation of the Bhagavad Gita that I've had since high school, and I have all kinds of notes in it and little markers and paper clips of important passages. Now, as far as Harrell's books go, I still think that as far as the Northwest, well, what is now, I'm sure there are four or five books now in the Northwest, I have to say that The Brigade is my favorite as far as really working as a piece of literature. Of course, I like Freedom Sons, too, but there's something very believable about The Brigade. And, of course, in Freedom Sons, you have to go into some degree of fantasy, and I suppose that's a more challenging task. And then, of course, there's a book I read recently, Aradharma, which is dealing with some practical advice, how one should live a virtuous life, you know, within this movement, you know, such as it is. So those are the books that really have stood out for me so far, and of course I hope to continue reviewing books on this show. This is a very important show, and I want to do everything that I can to help. So, I hope you enjoy my reviews, and so thank you very much for listening.
Good afternoon, comrades. I'm Olivia from Seattle. I recently received an article from a comrade regarding the murder of a white man in Southeast London, which sparked a lengthy conversation covering many topics, ranging from the race of the victim not being openly revealed, although watching the video, it was fairly easy to see that the victim was white, to rednecks, guns, and racism, and finally ending up on spirituality, religion, honor, and integrity. Although we touched on many things throughout the conversation, some of which are very important and really do need to be said, aired out, and worked through, the thing that stood out for me as most important at this point in time was the topic of honor and integrity. The point of this particular conversation had nothing to do with religion or spirituality, but I found the timing interesting in light of the fact that I had recently been doing some research on white religious beliefs, where I found references to honor and integrity being an integral part of who white people are and a main component of their societies and how they practice their spirituality and religion when they are at the top of their game. The particular information I'm referring to comes from the 14words.net website on a page discussing Aryan, or white, spirituality. When I first read the article, I was struck with the truth contained in it, although the author clearly states at the beginning that this is simply his opinion based on his studies and insights. I felt he defined a major problem facing us as a race right now, and since I can't say it any better than he did in quoting Alfred Rosenberg from Race and Race History, I'll simply quote what he says. There are two values which embody the almost 2,000-year-old conflict between church and race: theology and belief, enforced belief and pride in character. Two values which are rooted in will, and which are now battling for supremacy in Europe: love and honor. He goes on to state that love and honor cannot coexist and share the limelight. One will eventually become dominant, because honor is not always loving, and likewise love is not always honorable. He defines love as the love of humanity, or humanitarianism. Basically, the world we live in today of the Judeo-Christian tendency toward charity and love of all, despite any character flaws which might be present, which creates a society that accepts all people regardless of their character or background. A society based on love depends on the values imposed from outside to find or instill a sense of goodness in all of its citizens, and tends to take either a humanistic or an original sin approach to belief and judgment. It is based on the belief that all are created equal and have the same potential for growth and goodness, with the original sin component being the great leveler of all people. Its ultimate goal is to psychologically weaken anyone who has a high opinion of himself and produce people who are humble and love all of humanity, regardless of what they do or how they act. We've seen the horrible, disastrous results of living in this kind of society. Honor and integrity are ridiculed, and pride in oneself and one's race, especially if you're white, are not only mocked, but can have serious legal and even physical consequences. Please understand, I'm not talking about the Christianity of the past when absolute moral values existed and were honored, but about what passes for Christianity in this time and place and in this particular society. In essence, Judeo-Christianity. He then goes on to define honor as elitism, anarchism or fascism, and aesthetic or warlike tendencies towards self-overcoming. Anarchism in this context reflects the Aryan values of freedom and honor, where responsibility is placed solely on the head of the members of the society. Fascism is defined as the value of honor in that it seeks to place those who prove their honorable character and their excellence in a given field in the higher ranks of that field, thus recognizing that we are all not created equal. When honor is the defining characteristic of a society as opposed to love, certain individuals stand above the majority in character, excellence, and honor, and they should be recognized and respected accordingly, rather than lowered to the standard of the rest of humanity. From honor comes other values such as freedom, responsibility, virility, nobility, individual integrity, and so forth. In a society based on honor, honor is the moral compass, and life is based on doing what is right from the heart and taking full responsibility for our actions. Of course, this type of society can only flourish when the majority of society holds the same values, as happens in a racially homogeneous society, since races left to develop on their own tend to hold many values in common. Healthy white societies of the past were based on the value of honor and excellence, not only in a given field of endeavor, but also personal excellence, was pursued with vigor and zeal. These societies formed men and women of character with many great accomplishments, where loss of personal honor meant loss of standing in society. This is in stark contrast to the societies of today, where anything goes, and honor and integrity are cast aside as being of no value, just so much baggage from the past. It is the value of honor that separates white spirituality and philosophy from that of all other races. It is also the value of honor combined with that of integrity, which separates white society from all others. Only in a society based on race and honor can a white man or woman reach his or her full potential. We, as a people and as individuals, need to recover our honor and our sense of integrity, both of which have been stolen from us by the society we have allowed the Jews to create. Yes, we have participated in our own demise in that we, as a race, have valued the admiration of others and being part of the group more than we have valued our own honor and integrity. It's time to step up to the plate and recognize that without our honor and integrity, we are nothing, because it is honor and integrity that ultimately define who we are. The Northwest Front is seeking men and women who put the values of honor and integrity first in their lives, and are willing to do what it takes to secure the existence of our race and create a future for white children, regardless of what anyone around them thinks. Men and women who have the vision of what an all-white society can really be. Are you one of them? If so, we look forward to seeing you here in the homeland soon, where we're working to achieve this vision. Hail victory, comrades!
I had an email a few days ago from a guy who asked me, "Harold, why do you keep doing the same Edgar Steele piece over and over again? It's the same one you did on the YouTube video that you uploaded about the Steele case, and we've heard it all before," or words to that effect. Yeah, I suppose it is, and I imagine some of you are getting a bit bored with it. Now, I could give you a short, snappy answer to the effect that we have a terrible habit of abandoning our own once the prison doors clang shut, and we need to stop that. And I could also tell you that since the dictatorship clearly wants Edgar silenced for whatever reason, we have a moral duty to support him and make sure that his words are still heard. And all of that's certainly true as far as it goes, but it's a lot more complicated than that. So for the benefit of those of you who came in late, let me run a few things on the Edgar Steele case down for you just from my own personal point of view. Although I am not at all sure why the federal government of the United States made the decision to do what was done to Edgar J. Steele, the fact is that they did it. I don't think anyone who looks at that case with a shred of objectivity in their mind can question that the entire thing was an honest-to-God, for-real federal frame-up from beginning to end. Not conspiracy theory, but a genuine government conspiracy with the entire might of the world's most powerful tyranny combining to destroy a man in his late 60s who was just recovering from open-heart surgery. Now, I have to admit that for a short time after Ed's arrest in 2010, I wondered about him. The thought crossed my mind, well, you know, Ed's getting a bit long in the tooth. I had no idea what his marriage was like, and who knows, maybe under the influence of all the painkillers he was on after his operation, Ed's judgment was affected, and he said or did something stupid. Now, I could never see a man of his intelligence trying to hire a hitman, of course, and certainly never a Daryl and his other brother Daryl like Larry Fairfax. But the thought did cross my mind that Ed had succumbed to a momentary brain fart and he'd maybe done something really dumb. But almost immediately after the arrest, some really strange things started happening, which indicated to me that there was definitely something moving in the shade here. Now, for one thing, why was this a federal case? If this was just a matter of some bozo trying to hire the local drunk to knock off his wife, it would have been handled by the local police, which is how 99.5% of all other such cases I've ever heard of were handled. Why in God's name would the FBI interest themselves in a grubby little felony that the local sheriff could have handled if it ever actually happened? Then it came out that the alleged hitman, Larry Fairfax, was an FBI informant who was deliberately inserted into the Steele family before the alleged murder plot, and all of a sudden comes the dawn. But that wasn't the first odd thing I noticed, actually. Nowadays, everybody and his kid brother in the movement has got a podcast, but I don't know how many of you guys remember something from about 5 years back called the Jim Giles Radio Free Mississippi Show. Now, for a time, when Jim first got started up doing his live cast from his trailer down there in Canebrake, Radio Free Mississippi was one of the best and the funniest things we've ever done, and I was really sad when Jim got all disillusioned with the movement, as pretty much everyone does eventually, and he changed format and decided he was just gonna do it to try and make money, and so the show was no longer a labor of love like it had been, and now it's no longer on the air. But when Edgar Steele was arrested back 3 years ago, Jim's show was still on the air, and it was very much worth listening to. Anywho, the next morning after Edgar Steele's arrest marked the first appearance, so far as I am aware, of a certain internet identity. I have been informed as to who this person really is, supposedly. I.e., he's a man who about 15 years ago had a brief and rather unsavory association with the National Alliance, if this is the same person. Now, bear in mind that no one has actually physically seen this person for many years. All we have is a voice on some podcasts where he occasionally shows up, and it could be that this is someone else, a cognitive dissonance operative using the same name as the National Alliance associate of many years ago. I've also been given a physical address for this man by someone whom I kind of half suspect was trying to stir something and get me to harass the individual who lives at that address or do something with the address I shouldn't do, which is the kind of thing I don't do. Now, the information on the name and address does seem to be valid, though, and my guess is that this internet we're talking about most likely is indeed the same man who hung out with a very unpleasant National Alliance personality back in the nutty 90s. I'm sorry to be so obscure, and a few of you will recognize who I'm talking about, but I don't want to give this Nimrod any more exposure than is germane to the story, which is that on the morning immediately after Edgar Steele's arrest in June of 2010, when the entire white movement, such as it is, on the internet, which is basically all we are right now except for the Northwest Front. Anyway, when the entire movement was in a state of shock, all of a sudden this Yahoo appears out of the blue on Jim Giles's show and on his internet forum. Nobody's heard from him in years, if it is him, and he starts shouting at the top of his lungs that Edgar Steele is guilty, guilty, guilty. No reason for this conclusion was given. At this time, nobody had any information about the details of the case beyond the bare fact that Ed had been arrested. And yet this maroon was screaming like a banshee, Edgar Steele is guilty, guilty, guilty. I might add that he also appeared on Stormfront and VNN rattling off the same line. Now, no one has ever figured out why he did this, or why he chose this particular time after at least 8 years of lurking to reemerge. Well, so far as is known by any of the former NA people I've spoken with, this man never met Edgar Steele, had no contact with him at all, never mentioned Edgar Steele back during his NA days, if indeed, I say again, this is the same guy, which I'm not totally sure of, and in short, he just sort of appears in a cloud of green smoke on the internet like the Wicked Witch of the West, screaming that Edgar Steele is absolutely guilty and the FBI got it right and blah, blah, blah. Now, a lot of people believe that this yo-yo is one of my cyber stalkers because of his many subsequent bizarre public attacks on me, and now he is, yes. But what they don't recall, or never knew, is that this internet only turned his attention to me after I dared to disagree with him on the Jim Giles show and forum, which at that time, remember, was one of the more influential in the movement. Now, I basically took the line of, hey, slow down there, Hoss. Cool your jets. We don't have all the facts yet. Let's at least hear what Edgar has to say. He ain't having any. And so he turns on me like a junkyard dog, and he's never let up since. Although, like all these weirdos, he does kind of come and go on the internet in a pattern that seems, how can I put this, remarkably synced to the United States government's known fiscal year. Okay, now, I suspect many, if not most of you, have heard of a Jew named Cass Sunstein. He was one of Obama's court Jews for a long while, and he's now retired to Harvard Law School, which is a kind of posh country club where wealthy Democrats and liberals go to get put out to pasture, or else they go for a stretch of R&R between stints of so-called public service. I understand Sunstein is now on the short list for the next Supreme Court vacancy, which is one of the most sinister things I've heard for a long time. I know I need to get to the point or we'll be here all night. Anyway, back in 2009, when Sunstein was Deputy Communications Director in the Dictator's Palace, he wrote a paper or thesis on quote-unquote conspiracy theories, wherein he proposed that the dictatorship undermine the effect of the Internet and manipulate public opinion by infiltrating bulletin boards, blog comments, sections, so forth and so on, using quote-unquote non-governmental agencies, meaning off-the-books Internet operatives, in order to inflict what he termed cognitive dissonance on all us wicked extremists and conspiracy theorists and white boys in general. Sunstein defined cognitive dissonance in this sense as raising doubt in internet readers' minds about anything that opposed the regime or any information that the regime wanted suppressed or at least diluted. Basically, cutting to the chase, Sunstein advocated setting up a federal internet black ops unit to wage psychological warfare and disrupt and spread confusion and demoralization among people who oppose the dictatorship. This is all taking too long to explain. Just Google the words Cass Sunstein conspiracy theories and cognitive dissonance and see what you come up with. Anyway, the sudden appearance of this one internut out of the blue, who was all of a sudden all over the white internet screaming at the top of his lungs that Edgar Steele was guilty, guilty, guilty without any evidence at all, before any details of the case had been released, before all the other weird stuff about the Steele case came out, viciously attacking and smearing and shouting anybody down who disagreed with him. And for some reason, I never did get a take on being allowed to do this by certain moderators, being allowed and facilitated to slime a newly arrested movement figure. Now, all of this set my spidey sense tingling, and it still does. That little incident in the first few days after Edgar Steele's arrest, before this guy pulled in his horns, okay, maybe I'm paranoid, that's just got, to me, cognitive dissonance up written all over it. I knew very early on that something very strange and very bad was going on with that Edgar Steele case. Okay, I've been droning for a while, and it's time for a music break, so I guess all you rock and rollers have got one coming. Here's Ian Stewart and Screwdriver singing about the SS.
They kept the flame alight, the uniform of midnight, and silver on their necks. Their honor was their loyalty to join the Eastern Trek. They fought against such massive odds, and then glory in the fields. But history tries to put them down for their loyalty. Freedom, salvation, proud of the nation. They kept the flames alight.
I'm tempted to go on about my personal observations regarding the Edgar Steele case, but if I do, it'll take up the whole rest of the show, and I don't want to do that, so I think I'll continue my comments over the next couple of shows. Now, right now, I have another email from another James. Dear Harold, how can you say that the NF should avoid terms such as Aryan in our literature and business cards when northwestfront.org has Aryan on the first page? I have spoken to normal everyday white people, and from the impression I get, the first page of the northwestfront.org site seems to turn them away and prevent them from listening to RFN. Well, it's been a while since I've gone over this one, so let's take another crack at it. As a rule, yes, I prefer the use of the term white instead of Aryan, although I admit the term white is less precise. The reason for this is twofold. First off, most white people have been completely buffaloed and deceived by old World War II propaganda into believing that Aryan means blonde hair and blue eyes, which isn't true. Aryan does not necessarily mean Nordic. And for the time being, let's just lay all the 19th century racial theory aside, please, guys, because if we get onto that topic, this podcast will be 4 hours long. Now, we can discuss how many haplogroups can dance on the head of a pin another time. And God, don't we love to do that shit. Great way to while away endless hours in nice, safe bloviation on the internet and avoid doing anything productive. Now, right now, we're talking about the wordage we use in our NF propaganda material. So that's the first reason I tend to prefer the use of the term white, because the bulk of our people don't know what Aryan means. Or they think they do and they don't. Like Ronald Reagan said, the trouble with liberals is not that they're ignorant, but that they know so much that isn't true. The second reason has to do with the dumbed-down character and intelligence of white Americans, in addition to other no-nos like not cold proselytizing Americans with symbols and ideas and terminology that they've been conditioned from birth to reject. We must never, ever confront Americans with anything that looks or sounds foreign, especially European, and we must never confront them with anything that we have to stop and explain. Once we stop to try and explain something, we have broken their very fragile concentration, the automatic mental defenses and rejection protocols, which have been hardwired into their skulls full of mush by the Jews, start to kick in. And above all, the short American attention span kicks in. Now, Americans are capable of being intensely absorbed and interested in anything for 15 minutes. If we can snag their attention, we can do a lot of good and plant a lot of seeds of doubt into American skulls full of mush in that short time. But we need the whole 15 minutes before their minds begin to wander off and their eyes begin to glaze over. Now, we don't need to be stopping to explain ideas and terminology and symbolism which they simply are not mentally or spiritually or historically equipped to take in and which they cannot understand. Now, this is one reason why I myself no longer wear the swastika, although I am just as much a National Socialist now as I ever was. I have simply had to accept with the greatest of reluctance that the Jews have won that round and they have created such a complete fog of misinformation and myth about Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich that it is impossible to re-educate our people except from a position of state power wherein we control the media. Now, the first thing we have to do is place ourselves on a credible basis of communication with the people we are trying to persuade. And that can't be done by offering them some weird guru or cult that asks them to do things that they don't really want to do. Like all men have to wear 1930s buzz cuts and no screwing at all other than missionary position once a month with your wife for procreation. And everybody has to learn Latin. And a few times a year we all get together and dance around a campfire wearing jock straps with a goat tied up nearby. And by the way, I'm not making any of those up. Yeah, really. Remember, that's one tremendous advantage that we have in the Northwest Front. We are not offering to solve all of white people's problems. We're just promising to set them free and keep them alive so that they can solve their own, which means that the majority of white people want at least some of what we're selling, or they would if they were ever allowed by the media to know about us. Now, it is possible to be way too pure for your own good, to the point where you're a minority of one. Or a minority of maybe a dozen at any given time. Does the name Matt Cale ring any bells? If you insist on absolute ideological purity, then you will find that completely pure and perfect human beings are very hard to come by. Always have been. Now, all of that having been said, yes, you will find the occasional Arian in our material, plus other bits and pieces and hints that we are not exactly the good nigger-hating conservative good old boys that we sometimes pretend to be, and that we might have the occasional pointy-headed European foreign ideas creeping into our noggins. Now, the question is simple. Do we, in fact, have any ironclad and unbreakable principles, or are we pure opportunists? At what point does pragmatism end and betrayal of the truth begin? At what point does reasonable political and moral compromise in order to get things done become craven surrender and the loss of our identity and purpose? Practical political considerations are important, yes, but just how far should we cater to what is basically ignorance and stupidity? Should we allow our own people to remain stupid and ignorant of their own situation and their own true identity because it's too much trouble and annoyance even to try to educate them to the truth? How far backward do we bend over to satisfy certain critics who basically don't want us to succeed and don't even want us to exist because we're the competition? Now, if we continue to dilute our message and make our propaganda and presentation ever milder and milder until we're basically Rush Limbaugh clones, if we lie to people about who we really are, when does the point of diminishing returns set in? I don't know. You tell me. This is a question that has bedeviled our movement in one form or another for a long time, and I always like discussing it because it's one of the few genuine adult moral and philosophical conundrums we face. It's not over who among us stole this, or ratted on that, or buggered that, and Harold said something unkind about somebody in the 1990s, so we must all hate him forever. That kind of happy horse dung. At least if we decide to waste words on this, instead of packing the moving van for the Northwest, like we're supposed to be doing, we're talking about something mature and genuine. And yes, this segues into what is known in Europe as movement modernization. Now, there is room for a lot of discussion here, and if you guys want to kick this around in future podcasts, by all means, send me some emails or better yet, some MP3 files, but I want to say two things. First off, my line is drawn at so-called movement modernization when some wretched pale face, for whatever reason, advocates allowing Jews and bugger boys into our ranks on the grounds that A, the enemy is Islam only, and Jews are part of the quote-unquote European tradition. And yes, I have heard that very piece of ignorant horseshit dropping from the mouths of modernizers. And B, it doesn't matter what you do in bed, but what you do in the streets, which would be a little bit more impressive if anybody were doing anything at all in the streets. But yes, Virginia, perversion does matter and character does count. I mean, Jesus, if we're going to allow Jews and faggots among us, what's the point of any of it? I haven't spent the past 40 years of my adult life fighting for a world where any nickel-nosed heeb or any boy-buggering pervert has any place at all. And if any of you settle for that after I'm gone, my ghost will come and drag you screaming down into hell. There's another motivation behind this idea that we have to quote-unquote clean up our act and never ever use certain naughty words that might upset and offend, like the N-word or the F-word or the A-word or the A-H and the N-S words, and that is that we cannot seem to shake this idea that at some point there is going to come a time of a big mass movement wherein thousands and tens of thousands of people will be marching down the street, a nice big crowd for everybody to hide in. I mean, why run off into the North Woods and try and hide from Obama in a cabin if Harold will just quit fooling around and pull the magic beans from his pocket and give you a nice big mass movement to hide in? Now, the trouble is, it's not going to be like that, and this is what, the fourth or fifth time I've gone over this in the past couple of months? Okay, fine, we won't recap that one, except to say that the Northwest Front is, among other things, looking for that small minority of people who will understand why we use the word Aryan on occasion. Now, speaking of no mass movement of young white dumbasses, the other day I came across this song from the 1990s and I snagged it. We've spoken of the young white males who stay on in their parents' basement until they're no longer so young, for whatever reasons, real or bogus. This song is an interesting relic, an artifact from another age. The age of Clinton, when all young white boys were going to get out of school with an IT degree, do a software startup in their garages, and end up as rich as Bill Gates. Anyway, this song recounts Zog's official promise to the white youth of the 1990s in exchange for their conformity and their passive acceptance of the fact that this land is no longer theirs. Most white boys still have some idea in the back of their heads that this is how life is supposed to be for them. And I'm sorry to say that generally it's not until they hit age 42 or so that they look around and notice that they've been lied to and screwed. Although, I don't know, those years in mom's basement must give them some kind of clue before that. Anyway, this is the promise that America gave to a whole decade of young white males and then betrayed. Email from Edward in Toronto. Dear HAC, I hate to be pessimistic, but I personally don't believe that this kike-controlled government will permit any area of either the United States or Canada to become white again one way or the other. Now, this is a fairly standard naysay that we run into a lot. The objection to Northwest independence in a nation of our own is that the tyrant will not permit it. The implication, which all too many of us buy into, is that the dictatorship is all-powerful. It sees all, knows all, can do all with a single lift of its putrid finger, and accordingly we are restricted in our efforts to whatever the established power structure will, in its gracious condescension, permit us to do. First off, I can't recall a single successful revolutionary movement in the past 100 years that asked permission of the established order whether it wished to be overthrown or not. Can you? This is a serious response. It has to do with our mindset. We must get out of this idea that we can do only what we are allowed to do by an all-powerful Jewish system. We are white men, and we can do whatever the hell we want. Now, if we decide that we're going to establish our own country for white people in the Pacific Northwest, then by God, that's what we're going to do, and we will not be asking any kikes permission to do so. Of course we'll never get permission from the Jews to take away their power. What people who bring up this naysay are really telling us, and what all naysayers basically tell us, stripped of their specious verbiage, is that it's all hopeless. The white race is doomed. Doomed, I tell you, is doomed. And there's no point in struggling against the inevitable. We all need to give up, as these people have given up, accept our own deaths with dignity, and meanwhile get back into the comfort zone. I.e. go back to posting crap on internet groups that no one reads, and emailing each other depressing news stories. Now, this is a second thing you need to bear in mind about naysayers. They have no alternative plan because there isn't any. Their alternative plans, if any, stripped down, involve vague references to educating white people to the problem. In other words, the generation of endless words instead of deeds. They want us to continue to do the same thing that we have been doing for the past 50 years, which amounts to a bunch of sad old men mailing news clippings to one another, except nowadays we do it by email. Anything else might make the dictatorship mad and get us into trouble. Someone might actually come knocking on our door, which to most alleged white nationalists is the ultimate horror. All this talk about people actually moving to the Northwest must be silenced before the man comes knocking on our door, and all of a sudden it's no longer a computer game. Now, the dictatorship is not all-powerful and omnipotent. Even the Jews aren't really what they used to be back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Their control is not absolute. Now look at some of those Jew jokes on The Simpsons and South Park. Okay, hardly a pogrom, but I can tell you that as recently as 20 years ago, some of the things that we occasionally see on TV would never have seen the light of day, and their authors would have disappeared. Things are being said and written and published in mainstream media now that would have been unthinkable up until very recently. Jewish control is slipping, and will one day fall. It always does. Historically, the Jews always overreach themselves. Now we're dealing with a corrupt bureaucracy, incompetent, dazed, quavering with senility, sick inside and divided against itself. The United States government can't even whoop a small nation of 26 million ragheads. They're such stumblemums in military incompetence. And always remember the most important lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States can be militarily defeated by people who have the courage of their convictions and who are willing to put something on the table. The United States is getting its ass whooped right now by barefoot brown men, each with an AK-47 and a few magazines and a few homemade bombs. The mighty Marines and Strikers and Green Berets and high-tech toys of death can be beaten by men of any race, armed with plain, simple physical courage. Now, my novels are just that, fiction. But yes, we could beat the bastards as well if we ever discovered any remaining hair on our ass. As W.B. Yeats once wrote, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, the Ukraine, these countries are now no longer communist, and in some of these countries, people of our way of thinking actually have more freedom of speech and thought than we do here now. Soviet Russia went down and broke up. A similar situation will arise here, and the United States will break up. It is a historic inevitability. We have to be ready and waiting for that event to make sure that the white man gets a piece of the pie. Now we need you here for that. Get your ass up here. Our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.